Hello, and welcome to Ancient and Medieval History. I am your host, Catherine Loomis. The music you have just heard is track number 2, M'Pesa, by artist Tim Rayborn on his album Kadim, which can be found at magnatune.com. This week's episode was suggested by Mara from Goleta, California, and is about Pompeii. Most people who have at least heard of Pompeii can tell you it was a Roman city that was destroyed by the volcano Mount Vesuvius. They can possibly even tell you that it was destroyed in 79 AD. It was rediscovered in the 1730s and became an archaeologist's dream site in the 1860s. Due to the volcano's ash, the entire city was covered and everything preserved. This is true as well for the nearby city of Herculaneum. Pompeii became a Roman city in the year 80 BC. Before that, Greeks, Etruscans, and Samnites all had a part in the city's history and development. All of these countries at some point ruled the region for a period of time. Pompeii is only 5 miles to the south of Mount Vesuvius and was an average-sized city with an estimated population of about 20,000 inhabitants, a decent-sized town by today's standards. Pompeii was a merchant and port town. Located on the Cerno River, fish sauce and wine were its major exports. In ancient times, much like today, graffiti was very popular and helps give an insight to what people thought. In the case of business in Pompeii, an inscription found on a cloth merchant's wall says, "Salve lucrum," or "Hello wealth." It seems the Pompeiis kind of like to make money too. Beachfront property was also popular. If you lived in the middle of town in Pompeii, you were in the midst of hustle and bustle, and it could get very hot and crowded. On the coast, you had the breeze and hopefully some extra room. So those who could afford to moved out of the inner city or out of the inner town and more to the shoreline. About 10 miles northwest of Pompeii lay Herculaneum. Herculaneum was a smaller town, and the population is figured at about 5,000. However, there was not the same level of commerce as in Pompeii, and most of the citizens were fishermen, artisans, and craftsmen. Herculaneum did, however, have a small beach area and was considered more scenic and a nice retreat, and attracted some of the more affluent citizens as well. Politics were a big part of life, and the graffiti in Pompeii reflects this. Every March, the top officials, the duoviri and the aediles, were elected. Throughout Pompeii, there are numerous writings urging the election of different candidates. Guilds would have their say. One quote or one inscription said, "The goldsmiths unanimously urged the election of Caius Cuspius Pansa as aedile." Some people also had what equate to signs on your front lawn today during campaigns, except in their case they would be painted on the side of their house. Another painting or graffiti said, "If upright living is considered any recommendations, Lucretius Fronto is well worthy of the office." This sounds almost like a very simplified commercial that you would get for politicians today, where you would see their family and their wholesome, upright living. Now, while women were not allowed to run for office, they still gave their opinion, they still had their say, as a wall on one wine shop says. This wine shop also is thought to have been owned by a woman. The quote says, "Capracia, along with Nymphias, her neighbors too, ask you to vote for Aulus Vettius Firmus, for the aedileship. He is worthy of the office." Of course, like today's political campaigns, there was mudslinging and snide comments. One quote says, "Claudius's little girlfriend is working for his election as duovir." I wonder what this is implying. Graffiti didn't just cater to politics, but it also showed a bit of daily life. There are instances where people figured accounts, advertised, and showed what groceries were available. This is much like advertising today, except the signs couldn't just be replaced like you do our paper signs. Instead, they had to be repainted first, and then rewritten on the walls. In the case of listing accounts, a tavern could publicly record a patron's running tab so that it could not easily be disputed later. After all, if the whole town knows what you owe, the tavern owner can't get a better witness. There was a large amphitheater at Pompeii, and which saw much activity. In 59 AD, a riot broke out with Franz from a neighboring community. An advertisement from 79 AD states the next program. Basically, it states, 30 pairs of gladiators will fight between April 8th and 12th. There would be standard fights as well as wild beast combats. In another area of Pompeii, as a possible deterrent for thieves and as for decoration, there is a famous mosaic at the entrance of one house, which displays a dog and says, Cave Canum, which translates to, Beware of the Dog. Then, there is Mount Vesuvius. Around 1 o'clock on August 24th, 79 AD, Mount Vesuvius exploded. It had not exploded since about 300 years prior. About 13 years prior, there had been strong earthquakes, which may have led to this eventual eruption. A column of ash and pumice was sent about 12 miles directly into the sky. There wasn't any lava yet, but after half an hour, debris rained down and pumice and ash fell at a rate of about 6 inches per hour. After 11 hours of this, the column of the volcano collapsed. Herculaneum was spared the ash and pumice due to winds, so many may have remained in the town, thinking conditions looked worse than they really were. Yet, once the volcano's cone collapsed, surge clouds of gases and debris, over 212 degrees Fahrenheit, came down, along with the lava, which was over 700 degrees Fahrenheit, and they came at speeds between 60 and 190 miles per hour, or hurricane speeds. Herculaneum was only 4 miles from the volcano, so it was only a matter of minutes before the town was completely destroyed. Herculaneum was buried 65 to 100 feet below the volcano's wrath. An hour later, Pompeii was hit by a surge of lava, and whatever remained there was completely obliterated. There are two famous Romans, Pliny the Elder and Pliny the Younger, who were both affected by Mount Vesuvius's eruption. At this time, Pliny the Younger and his mother were living with her brother, Pliny the Elder, at Misenum, which was about 20 miles across the bay from Mount Vesuvius. From here on out, since they're both named Pliny, I'm just going to say the Elder or the Younger. The Elder is famous for his Naturalis Historia, or his natural history, which delved into all aspects such as botany, mineralogy, and anthropology, among other subjects. This work was written only 2 years before in 77 AD. His nephew, the Younger, was a famous orator and statesman. His letters survive in the Epistulae. The Younger wrote to his friend Tacitus, who is also a historian, what happened on that fateful day. His mother first saw the cloud erupting from Mount Vesuvius, and Pliny the Elder climbed to a point where he could see better. Curious, the Elder called for a small ship so he could get closer to the action. As he was leaving the house, he received a letter from a woman living at the foot of the mountain and realized exactly what was happening and how serious the situation was. Currently, he was the commander of the local fleet, and the Elder ordered the fleet to begin rescue operations and boarded one of the ships to join his men. Meanwhile, the Younger and his mother remained in Misenum and waited for the Elder to return. After waiting through the night, they were finally encouraged by a friend to flee. They made it just in time. The Younger's accounts have them running with the clouds to escape the ash and debris. At one point, while they rested, and I quote, "We had scarcely sat down to rest when darkness fell, not the dark of a moonless or cloudy night, but as if the lamp had been put out in a closed room. You could hear the shrieks of women, the wailing of infants, and the shouting of men. Some were calling their parents, other their children, or their wives, trying to recognize them by their voices. People bewailed their own fate or that of their relatives, and there were some who prayed for death in their terror of dying." After a night away from home, the earthquakes and eruptions subsided, and the Younger and his mother returned to Misenum to find the town buried under drifts of ash. There they remained until they heard news of the Elder. The Elder had gone to his friend's house and calmed them, if they did not immediately leave. Seems he did not quite realize how serious the situation was. In the early morning hours, the Elder woke to find his room covered in debris, which if he had not left at that point, he probably would have been buried alive. It was at this point the Elder finally realized that they really should leave, but it was too late. Again, the Younger writes, and I quote, they debated whether to stay indoors or take their chances in the open, for the buildings were now shaking with violent shocks and seemed to be swaying to and fro as if they were torn from their foundation. Outside, on the other hand, there was the danger of falling pumice stones, even though they were light and porous. However, after comparing the risks, they chose the latter. As a protection against falling objects, they put pillows on their heads tied down with cloths. Elsewhere, there was daylight by this time, but they were still in darkness, blacker and denser than any ordinary night, which they relieved by lighting torches and various kinds of lamp. My uncle decided to go down to the shore and investigate on the spot the possibility of any escape by sea, but he found the waves still wild and dangerous. A sheet was spread on the ground for him to lie down, and he repeatedly asked for cold water to drink. Then the flames and smell of sulfur, which gave warnings of the approaching fire, drove the others to take flight and roused him to stand up. He stood leaning on two slaves and then suddenly collapsed, I imagine because the dense fumes choked his breathing by blocking his windpipe, which was constitutionally weak and narrow and often inflamed. When daylight returned on the 26th, 2 days after the last day he had seen, his body was found intact and uninjured, still fully clothed, and looking more like sleep than death. Pliny the Younger's account is a very vivid one, and shows just how terrible the event was. After the town was rediscovered and archaeology began in earnest in 1860, voids were found in the layer of ash where bodies had fallen and eventually decomposed. The archaeologist, Giuseppe Forelli, filled in these voids with plaster, and once again people were able to view the horror and saw what Pliny the Younger only began to describe. Today, visitors can go to Pompeii and see the remains of the town. Because of the layers of ash and lava, the town has been preserved, even down to the grains and breads. There are still sections that aren't fully excavated, but most of the town is, and while not all of it is open to the public, visitors can see the Cave Canna mural, homes, and businesses. Some of them, with meals still on the table from when the owners ran quickly away, hoping to save their lives, and all their worldly possessions left behind. This week's book is Roman People by Robert B. Kebrick. It's an informative and relatively laid-back introduction to Roman history, and goes more in depth with the people themselves, not just the standard facts and figures, such as wars and leaders. Yet it is still quite informative and respected, and one that we used at university. I would also like to take a moment to correct something I said last week that was a little bit of misinformation. It has been pointed out that when I was talking about what I do in the SCA in our fighting, somehow, and I'm so sorry for this, somehow I said that the rattan we use to fight with as our swords was safer than boffers. Big oops. I think I must have gotten distracted in my thoughts while I was talking. Boffers are much, much safer than rattan, and that was kindly pointed out by one of our listeners. What I was trying to say was, we use the rattan as safely as possible, and so we do wear full armor. Meanwhile, boffers, since they are much safer, and you're not about to get hospitalized if you get hit over the head with a boffer, you can go at it with them, for the most part, without armor, just still be a little intelligent. So again, I apologize, and I really hope and pray that nobody has gone out and knocked up each other upside the head with rattan, thinking that they were safer than boffers. That was a big mistake on my part, and thank you so much for pointing that one out. So please, use full armor with rattan. Padded armor with rattan. That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening, and hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we're going to be doing a brief overview of the Teutonic Knights. You can check us out on the web at www.sportel.com/ancient.html, or you can email us at history@sportel.com. We've already had a bunch of people on our Frapper map, which it's really quite interesting to see exactly where people are from. not only the US, but we've had Sweden, Australia, the UK, France, and here in Germany. So by all means, stop by, pop a little peg in the map. It's always been interesting to keep track of different areas of the world. Ever since my grandparents had a map on their wall of all the places they visited, it's always been very interesting to me to see the world through a map and through other people's locations. And I hope you'll join us again next week. Thank you, and live to learn.